Please be seated. See that council are here and ready to go in Quality Auto versus State Farm and other appellees. Mr. Shurtleff is here for the appellants. Mr. Fenton and Mr. Kinney for the appellees. Mr. Shurtleff, you may begin.
Your Honor, good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Mark Shurtleff from Salt Lake City, Utah, and I represent the appellants, plaintiffs who are literally hundreds of mostly family-owned body shops, collision repair shops across this country, and whose very ability, no exaggeration, to stay in business has been severely impacted by the actions of insurance companies together in getting involved in their business and steering people away from them and fixing prices and controlling what happens when your car is being repaired. So what we're here to complain of, obviously, today is not whether these alarming allegations are true, obviously, but whether my clients will have the opportunity in their day in court to prove that those allegations are true.
I note that you failed to object to the portion of the magistrate judge's report and recommendation which discussed the antitrust claims. So therefore, I mean, we can consider those your objections waived now, can't we?
Well, no, Your Honor, because the Magistrate Smith in his report and recommendation basically said one sentence. That is, Judge Presnell had ruled earlier in a Florida case, A&E, on the issue of antitrust violations. And all the magistrate said was what he said, basically. He said, look, I'm not going to go over it. He did not address those in his report and recommendations. He simply said what the judge said then, and that's the same thing that the judge then later, Judge Presnell later did in ruling on dismissal of these cases before you. So, in effect, if I may, there was nothing to object to. Well, we are appealing what Judge Presnell did, not the magistrate.
Did Judge Presnell accept the recommendation of the magistrate judge with regard to the antitrust allegations?
Yes, but he accepted his own statement. So, and again, we're here more not appealing or opportunity to appeal the objections or the report and recommendation when it comes to the antitrust allegations. This is the Judge Presnell's original ruling, and we are appealing those statements. So there was nothing in specifically to object to.
Counsel,
because Judge did not make recommendations with regard to the antitrust actions.
You have a much better answer to that question. The magistrate judge's advice to counsel appeared at page 59 of the R&R. It said, specific objections to this report and recommendation may be filed in accordance with 28 U.S.C. 636 and Florida Middle District Rule 6.02 within 14 days of this report. Failure to file timely objections shall bar the party from a de novo determination by the district judge and from attacking fact findings on appeal. That does not satisfy the recent rule that we have about waiving objections. So, notwithstanding the fact that I think it's inexcusable, you did not object to anything except the tortious interference rulings. I do not think that you should be barred. We'll see what my brother and sister think, but I don't believe the companies catch you under the rule. The magistrate used the old language, and under the old case law, you're not barred.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. If I may proceed then, if that answers Judge Wilson's questions.
Well, you hope it does.
Well, I hope it does. Absolutely. And I would, again, I won't belabor the point that there was really nothing to object to as far as what his findings were and his recommendations when it comes down to
trust. He was, magistrate judge ruled on it, and the district judge accepted it.
Right, and in effect, accepting his own statements that we are appealing today with regard to the notice pleading. So as important, we believe, as this, the access to justice, which what pleading standards are, is clearly the right to fair notice, and you have to balance between those. And so our argument clearly here today is,
in any event, we have the authority to decide the issue, to look at the issue anyway, We have the discretion to do that. And if we find that you waived it, we can apply plain error review, or we don't have to apply plain error review.
So, understood. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a bit of a different question that I'm sure will take you aside from what you were going to talk about. Why wasn't this action pursued as a class action? Wouldn't that have avoided all of this group pleading stuff that you now have run into and I'm sure are finding somewhat difficult?
That question was discussed at length with our clients all across this country in every state we were doing this, Your Honor. These shops are very, very frightened. Their experience has been that they are being boycotted. Clients daily are being steered away, customers, because they don't follow all the rules that State Farm, in conjunction with all the others, are making. And so the fear was to be involved in any way, shape, or form. There are those few, now hundreds, because we're talking about all the states, who were willing to step up. And we just felt like it was it made more sense to file in each state in an MDL and get into a judge to decide the issues. So nothing other than just kind of a choice of which is better. We clearly understand, obviously, Your Honor is concerned with the alleged shotgun pleading, the group pleading standard. I will point out, though, since we've discussed what the judge did, Judge Personnel below, he really at the end did not say he did not have a problem, and he did not put in his dismissal the cause for dismissal being group pleading or shotgun pleading. He said, at the end of the day, even though you use the term all defendants all the time, he'll take it to mean that you truly do mean all the defendants are alleged to have been involved in the same conspiracy, the same agreements, the same conduct, the exact same prices that are set without any kind of market survey, the exact same refusal to not repair
the problem,
a long list of items.
The problem, however, with your price fixing and boycott allegations is that all you allege is conscious parallelism, parallel conduct, and Twombly and many, many other cases say that's simply not enough.
Clearly, this is a case, and has been made by the defendants, of conscious parallelism, that there is a parallelism, but that alone does not defeat the purpose, okay, or the rules when it comes to antitrust actions. There are, of course, as pointed out by Twombly and many other cases since, that you don't have to prove the existence of an agreement, that acting in concert alone is
Twombly,
not enough.
Twombly also says that merely alleging that there is an agreement or conspiracy is not enough. That's conclusory.
Absolutely. And our complaints are anything but conclusory in the list of
I take issue with that. You say in your brief that they used identical language and scripts. That is not in the complaint. I haven't read every one of the complaints, but I have read the complaint in quality. And I simply do not believe it's there. Do you have a paragraph that where they used the identical language? Or, you know, my law clerk checked it with one of these fancy computer machines, and he said it didn't use the word script and it didn't use the word identical.
The complaint itself does not use the word script, but certainly in multiple paragraphs, several dozen paragraphs, it talks about the fact that they are doing the same thing, that they're the same rules, the same reasons for not repairing or not paying for certain repairs. We certainly attached a long list of those repairs that are absolutely necessary to turn your car back over to you after it's been damaged. And they consistently refuse to pay for those, and it's a consistent across the board. So when we talk about script, that is a word that is not in the complaint, but certainly our allegations are in the complaint that the reasons for steering somebody away, for turning somebody away, for telling your insured you can't go to that person because we cannot guarantee the work, which is a false statement because they don't guarantee the work. They will say, you know, they're not on our list, they're not preferred, they're not good enough. These are the same excuses that insurance company after insurance company after insurance company, every named defendant, is doing the exact same thing, same script, if you will. Although that you're right, Your Honor, that word is not in the complaint itself.
Seems to me that might get you into one of the plus factors, but only if the reasons given were so idiosyncratic, but that they are not something that each company would come up with independently.
That's exactly.
And it seems to me that those are pretty obvious reasons. You charge more, you take longer, or you have quality problems. That's exactly what anybody in an independent thinking would say.
Yeah. Absolutely, and when it comes to the what they're paying for labor rates and parts and paint,
well, and the labor rate is easily explained as price leadership, and that's pretty clear. What you allege that State Farm leads, sets the price, all the other competitors find out what it is, which they can do readily. Mm-hmm. And then they follow it, and that makes plenty of sense.
Yeah, I agree. I understand that. That could be what is happening, but we believe we have alleged enough and our ability to show that it is much, much more than that, Your Honor. And that is that for the bottom line is there are no market studies. There is no market rate. It's not. It's a fiction. It's created by State Farm, and
antitrust standpoint, that doesn't matter. What matters is whether or not there's an agreement.
Right, and we believe
State Farm could come to the view that this is the price because that's what the market will bear.
But the point is they've not done any study to show that, and we've alleged that. How does State Farm determine what the market will bear in which market?
All they have to do is try it out, and it works.
Not if there's an antitrust violation, not if there's collusion, not if there's conspiracy. They just set it. They don't even try it out.
But whether or not they arrive at the price independently for reasons that you don't like or reasons that are not even logical, that doesn't matter. That doesn't show an agreement.
We understand that alone does not show the agreement, Your Honor. And the problem is that as what Judge Presnell did and what we would ask you not to do is to take each of these plus factors individually and say, that was not enough. That was not enough. That was not enough. That's not plausible. That fact is not plausible, as opposed to taking all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs and saying together, do they create a plausible allegation that this has happened? Now, when it comes to notice, some of the defendants' briefs have said that it's impossible for these insurance companies to know what we're alleging, and that simply is not the case. These detailed pleadings and the fact that we attached to our complaint the consent decree from 1961 to 63 that explained the exact same problem.
Hold up just a second.
Okay.
I think we ought to allocate maybe 3 minutes to unjustly enrich my family. Maybe want to merit together and then another 3 minutes to Tosha's interference. So we'll get on to each one of them. What do you think?
Sounds good. Okay. We are going to give you another 6 minutes so that you can address the state law claims.
Okay, I was going to try to do that on my final, but thank you very much. The state law claims...
Before we get to that, let me just ask you one question. What's the relevant geographic market?
It's each individual area where these shops are. So there should be different market rates for different areas in the country. And that's, again, there's no study that does that. They just set one across the country and it's followed by everybody else.
Don't you have to allege that in the complaint in order to get to the rule of reason? A relevant geographic market?
Yes. And
is
I
it
believe
in,
it is.
It's in the complaint?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I'm going to have, but I have to take a look. I can't point to it right now.
Okay. You might be able to do that on rebuttal.
We'll do that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Your request. We'll get to the state law claims.
Thank you so much. The state law claims are of course.
Let me get you started.
Sure.
Seems to me the unjust enrichment claim is wholly without merit because it's clear from the face of the complaint that you say in your complaint that all these defendants said they are not going to pay any more than State Farm. So these plaintiffs, every one of them, knew precisely what they were going to get for their labor and parts, and they took the job. Therefore, it's not unjust to allow this to remain in status quo.
Yeah, I understand the argument, Your Honor, and but I would argue that that is not entirely the case. When it comes to the labor rate, as far as the labor hourly pay that is set, they do know that going in. But the big problem is, as we listed in attachment 3 to the complaint, was this list of 62 procedures that may or may not be paid. Sometimes they are. I was just speaking with my clients today, and this, there is no bargain anymore. It's like, we'll pay that or we won't pay that. This will pay this. Feather Block and Prime, we won't pay for, but we'll pay for something else. To the point now where they don't even tell the agent, the repair shop, what they will and will not pay for. It's, here's the money, that's all you get, period. And so there is no bargain, there is no benefit they have accepted in this regard. And so in that sense, there is something done for the insurance companies, cars repaired for their insured, and it's paid for. But they don't get the benefit of that entire bargain because they're not being paid what it costs to do. And so they're eating that. They're having to eat that. They could pass it on to their clients, but I got to say, most of these mom-and-pop shops, the people come to them, they know them, they're friends. They're not going to eat it. They're going to eat it. They're not going to pass that cost on.
The quantum merit claims are very similar to the unjust enrichment for the same reason. It seems to me every shop knew what they were going to get paid or knew before they took the job that they wouldn't know precisely what procedures, but they knew it was a take it or leave it, and they took the job. Therefore, there's not unjust. And similarly, one of the other prongs, a couple of the states have a quantum merit that's one of the prongs is that the plaintiff would not reasonably be expected to be entitled to more. Or the fourth prong of some of the claims is that the circumstances were not such that the company was on notice that the plaintiff would be wanting more. And all of those boil down to the fact that these shops knew before they took the job that they were going to only get that much.
Well, as we pointed out in our brief, Your Honor, in New Jersey, which two of the complaints are from New Jersey shops, New Jersey law does not require a prior agreement on price to sustain a quantum merit allegation or claim. Neither does Virginia, for that matter, or Kentucky, excuse me.
But the problem here, there is an agreement. Before they take the job, they know, according to your complaint, they know that they're going to get that labor rate that State Farm does, and they know that either it's going to be a take it or leave it, like you say from the podium there. You didn't say that in your brief or complaints, but that too doesn't help you. They knew ahead of time, and they took the job.
Well, it's their lifeblood as how they get by, Your Honor, but they do not agree, and it's not required in New Jersey or Kentucky that they do, but they don't agree just to the labor rate they do, arguably. But when it comes to all the additional repairs that have to take place that are paid for or not paid for, when it comes to paint materials, all these things are things that the insurance companies decide, and they decide what you get, and there is no bargain. There is no agreement. They don't know, honestly, Your Honor, exactly what they're going to be paid. They get a check. They spend, some of these small shops have an employee that full-time, all they do is try and get paid by the insurance companies because
I'd like
they
you
don't
to
know
talk
what
a little
get.
Bit about tortious interference because I want to ask the companies about that. So I don't want to not be able to.
I appreciate that. The tortious interference argument was that the court admitted that it simply didn't believe the allegations of the complaint. For that reason alone, district court ought to be reversed. He did not give the benefit to the plaintiffs in this case. He simply did not believe these claims that we made. And again, he also pointed out the use of all defendants was a problem, but the 11th Circuit, of course, has said that using the defendants is permissible when the complaint intends to assert that all named defendants engaged in the conduct prescribed. In the context of multiple defendant lawsuit, again, the 11th Circuit has ruled that pleading specific allegations as to each defendant's conduct only are required when they're fraud allegations, and we're certainly not arguing that, Your Honor. The fact that insurance companies uniformly will tell their insureds, you cannot go to this place, you have to go somewhere else, or we will not guarantee the work, they're not qualified enough, they're not good enough, that clearly is that boycott, that steering, that becomes, under state law, the tortious interference with that business relationship. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Fenton. And since, why don't we give you, Mr. Fenton, an additional 3 minutes, and Ms. Harper will also give Mr. Kinney an additional 3 minutes.
All right, Your Honor, and I'd also like to, Mr. Goldfein, seated behind me, is prepared to answer if the court has any separate questions for GEICO, who filed a separate brief. Mr. Goldfein's prepared to handle that. I will be arguing on behalf of all the defendants. Mr. Kinney may have some separate remarks with respect to State Farm. I think one thing that I would like to address is a statement, really a theme of the plaintiff's reply brief, that the court below somehow adjudicated the merits of these claims. The court below did no such thing. The court dismissed the plaintiff's claims because it found the pleadings before it to be insufficient.
Well, there's a sentence in the district court's order that troubles me. He says, accepting the plaintiff's allegations as true, the defendants are simply refusing to be bound by third-party estimates that they're not legally obligated to follow. And then he says, if this constitutes parallelism, it is an extremely minimal version. And so, I mean, that suggests that the court didn't take the facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiffs.
Well,
it didn't accept the allegations as true. It's gone beyond the standard of Rule 12B.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I will address that in a moment. My point is, when you look at the action that the district court took, the complaints were dismissed without prejudice and with leave to amend. That is not a merits adjudication. The only reason it became a merits adjudication was because the plaintiffs chose not to amend and chose to appeal instead.
How is that relevant to whether or not the district court ruled on the merits?
Because the district court gave them leave to amend. The district court simply ruled that these pleadings were insufficient. And let me address, if I may, the issue that Judge Wilson raised with respect to the suppression of material and labor costs that the district court found. If you look at the allegations regarding suppression of material and labor costs, it starts out, and I'll use the Quality Auto complaint as an example. In paragraph 63, they allege that defendants independently and in concert force plaintiffs to accept less than full payment. That in itself is a contradiction in terms. This complaint does not identify who's acting independently, who's acting in concert, or in respect to what processes or procedures.
Yeah, but wouldn't you assume, given the wording, that they mean each defendant acted both independently and in concert? Independently, in that they made the decision to follow the rate that was set, and in concert, that they all chose the same rate.
Well, I think that I was talking about material costs, not labor rates. That allegation is a little different. The allegation with respect to labor rates, Your Honor, there is a litany of allegations about State Farm's practices in terms of conducting market surveys, looking at body shops, ranking body shops, finding a rate. And the only allegation against any of the other defendants, and again, it's a group allegation, is the defendants have announced that they will pay no more than State Farm. That's unilateral action. It is rational, independent business behavior. I mean, to give a real-life example, I brought a car in recently for repair. I wasn't putting it through insurance. They gave me an estimate. I said, is that what you charge State Farm? They said, no. I said, why don't you rerun the estimate and tell me what you charge State Farm, which they did, and that saved me a couple of $100. That's not conspiratorial conduct. That's just smart business. Now, with respect to the suppression of material and labor costs,
smart business on whose part?
On the part of a consumer of repair services.
Smart business on the part of the consumer, because the consumer won't pay any more than the State Farm.
Correct,
rate. Is
Your Honor.
That what you're saying?
Yes, and the same thing for insurance companies. Judge Anderson brought up the point about State Farm being a market Leader, other insurance companies know that State Farm conducts these surveys. They don't know the results of the surveys, but it's easy enough to say to a body shop, look, I'm not going to pay any more than State Farm pays. That's not a conspiracy. That's perfectly lawful, rational, competitive behavior. With respect to this list.
How do we know that's what happened without there being an opportunity to do any discovery to find out whether there was an agreement?
Well, because nothing more is alleged in the complaint, Your Honor. And I think what
Twombly, they allege an agreement, right?
They allege it in very conclusory terms. And I think Twombly on that one is controlling because you have nothing more than a conclusory allegation of an agreement. There are no supporting facts. There are no details of when this agreement was reached, who the participants were, what was said, how the agreement manifested itself. And so there's absolutely no direct case for
an agreement. Now, wait a minute. Two of those things we do know. How it manifested itself, they've alleged that everybody's paying the exact same price.
Right, which is characteristic, Your Honor, of a competitive market, actually.
You've said that, and I'm just telling you that in terms of what was alleged in the complaint, that was alleged in the complaint. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. At this point, how would they know? You think everybody got together in a room somewhere and plaintiffs would know that?
No, Your Honor, if you look at the allegations of the complaint, what happened is State Farm conducts these surveys. It basically determines what it's going to pay. And other insurance companies say, you know, I'm not going to pay any more than that. That's what's alleged in the complaint, Judge. And nothing beyond that. And they don't even allege that there is some kind of firm agreement. They talk about consciously parallel conduct. Well, as discussed with Mr. Shurtleff, parallel conduct has to be something more. You have to have plus factors, and no plus factors were argued below in the district court.
Well, their estimates for auto repair are all surprisingly similar. That's a plus factor, isn't it?
Well, the estimates are prepared by the body shops, Your Honor, and the plus factors that were identified by the plaintiffs in their briefs, not below, but in the briefs.
Most of the defendants are subsidiaries or affiliates or otherwise related?
There are a number of defendants, Your Honor, that have corporate families. They have different subsidiaries that may insure different kinds of risk pools. That's just ordinary organization, corporate organization in this industry. That's not a plus factor. That doesn't suggest any anti-competitive conduct.
Do you really think that, I believe the argument was made that one shouldn't do sort of what you're doing now, take each individual instance separately and say, well, that's the way that business is done, and that's the way that business is done, rather than look at the totality of the circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I understand that argument, but I would also say that if the sum total of, you know, zero is still zero, and they haven't identified any plus factor that carries them over the threshold, they haven't identified any information sharing between the defendants. With respect to this list of 63 processes that Mr. Shurtleff mentioned, one of them has to do with using competitive parts that are either manufactured by somebody other than the original manufacturer or that are salvaged from used vehicles. That's just an alternative, cost-effective source of parts. Any defendant would have an individual motive to use less expensive parts in the repair process. And so that doesn't suggest any collusion. If you look at the rest of that list,
don't they also allege that they're using parts that might in fact be unsafe or will wear out sooner than new parts that the repair shop would not have chosen to use if they thought they had the freedom to make the choice?
Again, Your Honor, that is a very conclusory allegation. There is not one instance in this complaint of a car being rendered unsafe because of the repair practices. And I would also suggest this in evaluating the plausibility of that allegation, Your Honor. No one, and I mean no one, has a greater interest in ensuring the safety of automobiles on the road than the auto insurance industry, which founded the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which has saved countless lives over the years. It is simply not plausible that the very people who insure automobiles and who insure bodily injuries are going to compromise safety. And again, with the list of the processes and procedures, it includes things like cleaning the car, reconnecting battery cables, applying masking tape, tire disposal, bonding materials, moving the car into a stall. I mean, just as a consumer, I would question whether I should have to pay separately for those kinds of procedures. Why isn't that part of overhead? Why isn't that part of the cost of repair? And that is the precise allegation at paragraph 70 of the quality auto complaint. The allegation is that the defendants claim it is part of overhead or a cost of doing business. You don't have to be a conspirator to raise those kinds of questions with respect to these processes or procedures. So again, I don't think that anything that the plaintiffs have alleged here raises this case above the bar of what you would see independent, rational actors doing in a competitive marketplace. It's simply not there. With respect to the boycott claim, you've got the added problem that there's simply no boycott. There's no allegation that any of the defendants refused to deal in any way with the plaintiffs. There are claims that defendants, whoever they may be, may have tried to influence their customers to go to other shops. But there is absolutely no allegation that any defendant said to a customer, if you use the plaintiff's shop, I will not pay.
What if they say that they'll withhold rental cars from the customers? Wouldn't that be a plus factor?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And again, there's no details provided of any of that. It is inconceivable to me that 89 defendants... And Judge Presnell made this observation, 89 defendants have taken the position that they will withhold rental cars from their customers if these shops are used. I mean, talk about, that simply is not a credible allegation without more specifics, and that's part of the problem with this complaint. It does not pass a Twombly test. That also factors into, by the way, Your Honor, the tortious interference allegations, which, of course, are not conspiracy claims. None of the state law claims are. And in each of those claims, the defendant is entitled to reasonable notice of the allegations against it, just as if it were being sued separately, which is a particular problem of this group pleading with respect to the state law claims. If you were to take this complaint and file it individually against my client, Allstate, and say, look here, these allegations are sufficient to state a claim against Allstate for violations of these state laws, there's nothing there. The only allegation about Allstate is the state of incorporation.
I'm worried about the group pleading. Frankly, in my mind, all of the other claims fall readily. My brother and sister may not agree with me on that, but I think the other claims are wholly without merit, and therefore the group pleading is moot with respect to them. But the tortious interference claim is made out, I think, on the merits of the elements, but the district court ruled only on group pleading, and I'm worried about that ruling because the basic problem with group pleading is you don't know which defendant did what. But here it's pretty clear that the allegation is that every one of these defendants did each of these things that we're talking about. I don't see why every defendant wouldn't know. And most of the complaints on appeal here are individual complaints by a single plaintiff, so we don't even have multiple plaintiffs except in the Missouri case. Geico, for example, I won't use it because he doesn't necessarily, your client is what?
Allstate, Your Honor.
Allstate knows that paragraph 82, and I'm looking at the quality complaint, says that your client steered, and the only allegation relevant to tortious interference is steering, that your client steered customers, insureds, away from this particular plaintiff. And by making representations that are, he says, untrue about quality of service, price, and so forth. I don't understand why each of the defendants doesn't know exactly what is alleged as to that defendant.
Well, let me answer. The question has several parts, Your Honor, so let me first say group pleading was the basis on which Judge Presnell dismissed it, but there are plenty of alternative bases, and I'm sorry, contrary to the reply brief.
Let's stay with the group pleading a minute. I went through those alternative bases for tortious interference, and I doubt that you prevail on that, but let's assume you don't, and the only thing you got is group pleading. Tell me why we shouldn't vacate on that if everything else falls away from you.
Because the group pleading includes no underlying facts. There are absolutely no facts alleged here.
They steered customers away from this particular plaintiff and only one plaintiff in this body shop. And they did it by saying to anybody that's non-compliant, that page, paragraph 82 and so forth, talks only about non-compliant plaintiffs, and because I'm non-compliant, you steered customers away from me by misrepresenting facts about quality and price and so forth.
But even if one were to assume that that allegation were sufficient, Your Honor, and I don't think it is, more has to be shown for tortious interference. There has to be...
You get into the merits of the elements now.
As Twombly, I believe, requires us to do, there has to be more than simply
sure,
a recitation.
Sure. But you're about to concede that group pleading was wrong with respect to tortious interference.
I'm not going to concede that,
well,
Your Honor,
my
because
question,
I do think...
Answer my question.
I do think that there is an implausibility here. That each defendant acted in the same way, and it is virtually impossible.
Don't have to have that for tortious interference.
I understand that, Judge, but it's virtually impossible because of this group pleading device
to sort out what
defendant did what and when.
Each defendant looked at a non-compliant plaintiff, steered customers away from that particular plaintiff. By telling his insureds, your company's insureds, that the company, the body shop, charged more, had bad quality, took too long, or something else like that, all of which is alleged were misrepresentations.
And, Your Honor, when it's alleged in paragraph 82, it talks about body shops generally. It is not, I believe, specific to the particular plaintiff shop.
That's true, but this is one plaintiff bringing this suit.
I understand that, Your Honor, but when you look at the allegations in paragraph 82, they are talking about the general market practices of the defendants. When you get to the tortious interference claim, they are saying, specifically, you did this to me. Well, it doesn't say when we did it. It doesn't say who did it. It doesn't say what customer was involved. It doesn't have any of the basic facts which would establish a business expectancy. So I do think the pleading is deficient, and I do think that the group use of the group pleading in tortious interference, where, after all, this is an individual complaint, this particular defendant harmed me. The use of the group pleading in the individual tortious interference claim is inappropriate, which is what Judge Presnell found. And I do agree with that. And that is not a point, respectfully, Your Honor, that I'm willing to concede.
That's my question on that.
All right. Thank you. We've let you go way over, Mr. Fenton.
All right. If I may make one other comment, Mr. Shurtleff indicated that he is representing hundreds of plaintiffs. There are 8 involved in these complaints. Thank you.
In this particular appeal, there are a whole lot more that he does represent.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Kenney on behalf of State Farm. I'd like to be very brief if I could. I just want to make some points that are particular to State Farm, because if you read the 5 complaints, the only company that you ever read about in any paragraph, with very, very 2 small exceptions, State Farm. And State Farm is alleged to be the, quote, spearhead, close quote, of this massive conspiracy in this tranche of cases in 5 states for antitrust allegations. There are a few things that are really important to note about what's not alleged and then about what is alleged. And then I want to address a question, Judge Rothstein, you asked Mr. Fenton. What's not alleged is when this conspiracy began. When you read these complaints, presumably this conduct started in time immemorial. We just don't know. Unlike many antitrust price fixing or boycott complaints, even in Twombly itself, there is some kind of triggering event that causes a change in behavior by the defendants that plaintiffs can point to and say, there's a departure here, whether it's pricing, whether it's conduct, whether it's abiding by estimating software companies or something. There's nothing like that here. But what do you have here? You have, well, one more thing, what you don't have. You will read all 5 of these complaints, Your Honors, until you get red eyes like all the lawyers in this courtroom have done, and you don't read a single time that State Farm ever once communicated by phone, in person, by email, by letter, by public disclosure with any other particular defendant. That's completely absent. So what
they do have allege here? That they met together, but of course we got case law says that's not enough.
They have not alleged that they met together, Your Honor. There's only one allegation about any meeting whatsoever, and that's the allegation that in all 5 of these complaints they denominate as illustrative. It was a meeting in April 2013 in Mississippi. That was a meeting that involved State Farm, the Mississippi Department of Insurance, and some plaintiffs. And there was a stray reference about some industry meeting in Mississippi.
Somehow or other, they all found out the same price, right?
It depends on what you're talking about, Judge Rothstein. If you're talking about, like, the labor rate.
Labor rate. Let's start with the labor rate.
Okay. Now, the thing that's very important about the labor rate, they make allegations about State Farm survey. There are no allegations that State Farm combined, conspired, colluded, and did anything with any other defendant in terms of how it performed the survey, its decision to do a survey. In fact, these complaints are remarkable as antitrust complaints in as much as if you look at the word, if Judge Anderson's law clerk went back on the computer and searched the words unilateral or unilaterally in the same sentence with State Farm, he or she would find that that occurs more than a dozen times.
There's nobody saying that it's, the survey was done other than unilaterally.
And so
let's move on to the fact that they're all charging the same labor rate.
Now, 2 things about that, Judge Rothstein, and that goes to the question you asked Mr. Fenton. First, the only way they link State Farm and State Farm's rates is to, in a conclusory fashion, talk about, well, there was an agreement or a conscious parallel behavior. Twombly answers your question, Judge Rothstein. If all you have is parallel conduct, and that's all they allege here, game, set, match, you can't get out of the starting gate. It doesn't nudge the case towards plausibility. But Iqbal then punctuates that point. The Supreme Court and Justice Kennedy and Iqbal said Twombly adopted a 2-pronged standard, okay, on a 12B6 motion. And this court in the American Dental Association case versus Cigna, and most recently the Almenza case versus United Airlines, it was decided on March 13 of this year, makes the same point. And that is...
You got what's the name of that case and the site?
The Almanza versus United Airlines. It's a Westlaw site, Your Honor. It was decided March 13.
That's good enough.
Okay,
good
thank enough. You. But what Iqbal says is the first prong of the analysis is you read the complaint and you strip out conclusions. If all you have are conclusions, they are not entitled to an assumption of truth. They're gone. That disposes of these antitrust complaints because all you have are allegations that the defendants, quote, agreed, or that the defendants engaged in conscious parallel behavior, which by itself, if that's all you have, put aside the fact that it's just a conclusory allegation, if all you're alleging is conscious parallel behavior, you're out on that point too. So that's the answer to your question, Judge Rothstein, about, well, they said that they all agreed. So even if they all paid the same price, as Judge Anderson pointed out in a point with to Mr. Shurtleff, all that describes at most is price leadership. But what is also remarkable about these complaints is there's not a single allegation about the pricing. They don't say, for example, in 2012, here's State Farm announced that it would only pay X for certain services or for certain labor, and the other defendants paid that same price or even a similar price. They give you no basis to conclude that their factual basis to conclude that there was even parallel pricing. And that's pretty remarkable, and that requires dismissal of the antitrust case.
I'm going to ask him a question. You heard what I said to your brother about group pleading and tortious interference?
Yes, Your Honor.
To be frank with you, and of course everything we say here is very tentative, but that didn't satisfy me. Do you have any better answer?
Here's the way I would look at it, Your Honor. Imagine that the complaint was one of the five plaintiffs versus State Farm and only State Farm. And the only allegation was that State Farm steered or disparaged or encouraged its policyholders not to go to that plaintiff, to go to some other plaintiff. Well, what I think Twombly and Iqbal require, what this 11th Circuit precedent following Twombly and Iqbal, is the fact, what Supreme Court, what Justice Souter said in Twombly, it needs factual heft. You can't just say, give a formulaic recitation of the elements, and that's it. You got to have some factual heft here. And that was Mr. Fenton's point, I think. If he was just X plaintiff versus State Farm, if you're the district court judge, Judge Rothstein, you're reading the complaint, you'd say,
Well, you're not answering the group pleading. You're saying if it was only against State Farm, then it failed on the merits of the elements. But what about the group? Assume for purposes of my question that there is sufficient allegations with respect to the merits of the elements of tortious interference. If you can defend the dismissal on the basis of group pleading, because there are 25 to 48 defendants.
I know you're getting frustrated, Judge, but Rule 8 notice, it would fail on Rule 8 notice. The group pleading is just a subterfuge to get around making the allegation with specificity of factual heft, other than simply giving a recitation of the claim. The group pleading here, our point is, it exacerbates the problem of, just assume it was one plaintiff and one defendant. It fails on Rule 8 based on Twombly and Iqbal.
I don't understand that. It seemed like to me, let's take one of the complaints, as it seems to me about 25 plaintiffs. Each one of those 25 defendants can say, I see the allegation against me is that I steered customers away from this shop by misrepresenting when that customer was noncompliant. That is, it was not paying what I wanted to pay. It kept on trying to raise the rates. Seems to me that it also says a chosen, this is after the insured had chosen that body shop. So there's the business relationship. There's and the allegation is that there was this steering, and therefore you know that the allegation is that this my company, my insurance company, steered my insureds away from this particular body shop, and I did it by misrepresenting. So you know what to defend. You say, well, that body shop is 100 miles from where my insured lived, so there wasn't any possibility of that or some other such defense. But you know how to defend, and that's the crux of group pleading, isn't it?
Judge, I think you're walking yourself right into the Supreme Court's Iqbal decision. In Iqbal, Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, said it's not enough to say, have an unadorned factual allegation of the defendant harmed me. Now, here on tortious interference under all four states, there are certain elements of tortious interference. One of them, of course, is a tort. Under your hypothetical, or the way you're characterizing the case, perhaps they've alleged a tort. But the other elements of the claim, to make out a claim, is you've got to put it together with a business expectancy or a customer relationship, and they haven't done that.
It says in paragraph 82 that they were the insured chose my shop.
Which insured?
The insured of each defendant.
But no, Your Honor, that's the problem. If you read the complaint, they don't identify any insured at any point in time. Did this happen in 1957? Did this happen in 1967? Did this happen in 1977? They don't tell you, Your Honor. There's nothing in their complaint that tells you when it happened, who it happened to. And so, like the quote about judges aren't here to be like pigs searching for truffles in briefs where there's no citations, that's what they're asking us to do. They're just saying, okay, I'm just have these generalized allegations. I dare you to deny it, and then unlock the door to this
okay,
massive
let me,
discovery.
Let me take a stab at trying to figure why you're talking at cross purposes. Judge Anderson is telling you to assume that there are adequate allegations in there to get tortious interference there. Mm-hmm. I think what he's concerned about, if not, I'll say what I'm concerned about. I think the next issue is notice. Is there enough notice? Why isn't there enough notice? Because of the group pleading. Is there a lack on the part of the group pleading that doesn't alert the defendants to what is being pled against them? And that is, don't keep answering the fact that the allegations are insufficient. We got that argument. You think right. That under Iqbal and Twombly, they haven't put out enough. The question is, do you think the defendants don't know what is being alleged against them?
And the answer is, we know partially what's being alleged. The group pleading, I think it's a fair reading of the complaints to say, in conclusory allegation that all defendants did all this stuff at some point in time, yes, we can read the paragraph that lays out what the five or six elements of what they allege every single defendant did. Whether that's plausible is for Your Honors to decide. We don't think that's plausible. But what we are not on notice of, that's just half, that only gets them to midfield on a tortious interference claim. They still have to allege and put us on notice as to who. Where was the tort committed? Against which policyholders? When? At what time? And they haven't done that. And have failing to do that, they have not put us on notice. And failing to not put us on notice, they have failed to survive 12b-6, Your Honor.
I think we have your argument, Mr. Kinney. I thought you said at the beginning that you were going to be brief.
I think it was my fault he wasn't brief.
Okay. Right. Mr. Shurtleff, you've reserved some time.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you very much. Just to follow up on the most recent line of questioning.
Well, where's the heft, the facts? Where are the examples in the complaint? The examples,
the steering?
Factual heft of parallel, of conscious parallelism.
Well, We admit that there's parallelism here, but the heft is, Your Honor, in plaintiff's arguments and allegations that in the absence, even though we can't point to a day and a time and an agreement was written, in fact, the insurance companies learned their lesson from 1963 in the Department of Justice, brought an action against them, and they all agreed not to do a list of things that are specifically stated and attached to the complaint, which we're saying they're doing again. So having been caught with evidence of meetings and discussions and not emails but letters and so forth, they clearly now had a reason to conceal the ongoing conduct because the conduct continues even these many years later. And so the steering, again, in paragraph 82 and others, as Judge Anderson points out, very clear about what they say and to whom they say and what reasons, consistent reasons, they alleged. But at the end of the day, we believe and have alleged that an exchange regarding an exchange of information or an agreement or conspiracy, that identical pricing policies, identical ways of handling disobedient children, if you will, is that does not happen in the absence of some type of an agreement. So the legal inference, if you look at the legal inference in light most favorable to the plaintiffs as required, there would be variability in the absence of an agreement. There would be variability. If I could just finish on the whole issue of notice, obviously it's very clear that each of the defendants know exactly what we're alleging. They can prepare their defense. They can certainly respond to discovery requests and ask their own discovery to get to the point where we clearly have to stand before an impartial trier of fact and make our case as to the specifics of these cases. But if we could just talk back up the overall purpose of antitrust laws, obviously, was to make sure that in this free market economy that the playing field is level. And the fact that it's there in this case, you have to think about what is the interest of the insurance companies in all agreeing to the same price and all agreeing to only repair the same things. How does that benefit them in the market? How does that give them an advantage? How is there not competition? Just two things to consider. First of all,
it benefits the consumer, though, doesn't it? Because it keeps prices down.
That's their allegation, but we would argue contrary to that. If insurance companies are able to make their own decisions and are making their own decisions as far as pricing, whether it's how much to pay, and some may agree to pay more. Mm-hmm. Some may agree that it's in their best interest in order to compete in the market, try and get more market share with a State Farm or a Geico, is to do more to work with the repair shop and to provide all the services that need to be done on your car, and pay for it when they do feather block and prime, meaning they patch a hole in your car and they have to sand it smooth, or you're going to have a pretty ugly finish on that car, right? They won't pay for that. None of them will pay for that. But if some insurance companies would provide more of those services, if they would, in fact, not require more dangerous aftermarket bumpers and other parts of the car and would pay for new parts, more safer parts, then they could obtain that market advantage in a way different than pricing. And that is to gain that reputation and working and word of mouth as to the benefit to the consumers and the customers. Bottom line is right now there is no competition either in the insurance market, and there's no competition, free competition in the repair markets, because they all have to toe the line or they're interfered with tortiously, if you will. So I appreciate that. I hope that ask the court to reverse the decision below and send us back and let us prove our case.
Thank you. Thank you. The court is in recess until 9:00 tomorrow morning.
Let's do it again sometime. No. I'm just anxious with my new talk. It's like 300 pages long. So. Hey. Certainly appreciate cordiality and all of his predecessors.
the professionalism.
Oh, that's okay.
I'll do a little of my work while I'm up here.
Nothing there.
Thank you.